WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Jazz Week on our show. Pianist Marion McPartland is one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz. She's now in her early 80s. She's made her mark not only as a musician, but as the host of the NPR series Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. If there is such a thing as the jazz life, McPartland's background was not the perfect preparation for it. She grew up in England in a proper upper-middle-class home where classical music was appreciated while jazz was heartily disapproved of. She moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of her 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband, but since the early 50s, she led her own small groups, playing more modern music. Jimmy McPartland died in March of 1991, a month after he and Marion remarried. Here's Marion McPartland, recorded in 1953 at the 52nd Street Club, the Hickory House. I spoke with Marion McPartland in 1987.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
Oh, I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it would represent it something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash." So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then actually after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people, and of course because of Jimmy, working with his group.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of, and kind of secondary to, the man who was performing.
Did that ever happen?
Funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus, plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent. And he was always introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He was seemed to be very proud of what I did. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio, Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, oh, that's terrible. You know, they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room. And I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't a sort of a falling down drunk. He just got very slow and boring, you know. And the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune and we'd all be saying, oh, for God's sake, get on with it, you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life. And it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy.
Did that have anything to do with your wanting to lead your own trio and getting out of playing with him?
No, I don't think so. Not at that time. I don't think so. I think it was just inside me there was this real, must have been this real determined ambition to get ahead. I'm somebody who, as they say, likes to take care of business, you know,
right.
the phone calls and all the things that are really such an important part of doing a job. You can't be late. And you've got to be well-rehearsed and know what you're doing at all times.
We'll get back to our 1987 interview with pianist Marian McPartland after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with pianist Marian McPartland. You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown. So that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so. They would.
You know what might have been helpful to you, too, being married to a jazz musician? And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because I'm
No, that's true. That's true.
You know,
and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance, there wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. Although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
Well, speaking of the opinion of other people, I was reading a Newsweek review of your work from December 30th of 1957.
Oh, my God.
And it said that you played, quote, a romantic arrangement of On the Alamo. And then a little later, her style turned masculine and aggressive as she swung into From This Moment On. And I love that because I don't think that they would have called it a romantic arrangement if it was a man playing a ballad. And then as it was aggressive, it turned masculine. And you must have run into that a lot.
Yeah, that it's funny because after a while, that did start to annoy me. And I would think every time that you would get a little stronger or more forceful. They didn't say that. They didn't call it strong or forceful. It was either aggressive or masculine. And people would say to me, oh, you play just like a man. Or else they'd say, oh, you play good for a girl. And after a while, in the beginning, I sort of took everything as a compliment. But then I would think, well, why does it have to be aggressive? I don't like that word. It just makes me feel so that I'm sort of hunching my shoulders and punching the piano. You know, why does it have to be aggressive? Why can't it just be with more strength or more a more forceful player? So gradually over the years, I think all that stuff has changed. And I've noticed nobody says that anymore.
Right. You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording. And then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of, in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow, upward...
It's amazing.
Rise, and every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful. And I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think... Well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else, and I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more, I should be able to play more, and I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better, you should be able to play better, you should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
probably
the wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
Pianist Marion McPartland, recorded in 1987.